and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the continuing protests in Hong Kong, where the use of tear gas by the police appears to have backfired, prompting ordinary citizens to join the students in growing demonstrations that are surely making Communist Party leaders in Beijing nervous. A professor of political science at Notre Dame University, who has worked in the democracy movement in Hong Kong and now serves on the Academic Advisors Committee of the International Centre on Nonviolent Conflict, joins us to discuss the Communist Party's crackdown on social media as Beijing tries to contain the contagion of democratic protests from spreading to the mainland. Then we'll speak with a leading expert on China's culture, language, and people, Perry Link, who edited the Tiananmen Papers, a collection of documents leaked by a high-level Chinese official that chronicle the before and after events of the student massacre of 1989, the publication of which led to Perry Link being blacklisted by the Chinese government in 1996. We will discuss how the shadow of Tiananmen hangs over the Politburo as President Xi Jinping erects a media firewall to keep the Chinese people in the dark about protests in Hong Kong, while promoting an anti-corruption campaign at home, largely designed to placate its angry citizens by going after minor local officials and the occasional big fish, who is invariably a high-ranking political rival of the president's. Then finally, we'll examine the latest fighting in Ukraine, where 9 Ukrainian soldiers died on Monday from shelling by pro-Russian separatists in the midst of a supposed ceasefire. A former Swedish diplomat, Anders Aslan, the co-chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Kiev School of Economics, joins us to discuss the devastated state of the Ukrainian economy and the increasingly debilitating effect of Western sanctions on the Russian economy, and whether President Obama's recent assessment on CBS's 60 Minutes of Putin's predicament rings true. And joining us now is Victoria Hoy, who's a professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame, where her research examines the dynamics of international politics and state-society relations in historical China and historical Europe. She is the author of War and State Formation in Ancient China and Early Modern Europe, and has worked in the democracy movement in Hong Kong, and now serves on the Academic Advisors Committee of the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict. Welcome to Background Briefing, Victoria Hoy.
Thanks for having me.
And this so-called umbrella revolution that's underway now in its fourth day in Hong Kong, my understanding is that the police use of tear gas has really backfired, and these weary students are now being joined by office workers at the end of the day are joining in. So these protests seem to be getting bigger rather than being run off the streets.
Yes. And in fact, I teach a number of courses on contentious politics. I suppose the CY, the chief executive, really should have taken some lessons from contentious politics. The main idea is that when you repress people, sometimes, or obviously, the idea, the intention of every authoritarian ruler is that you can just shut people up, you scare them, so that they basically would just shut up and go home. That was CY's intention in using tear gas. Except that very often, instead of shutting people up, you wind up getting people very angry. And this is called backfiring. And you, in fact, last Thursday, right before all of this happened, I guess there was 2 students protesting, and then Occupy Central had announced that they were going to actually start on October 1st. I was talking to my friends, and because there was a colleague who actually came to give a talk on other issues, and then people asked her questions about Hong Kong, and she didn't know and turned to me. And I was saying that if I were to advise CY, the best thing to really kill all the protests would be just to ignore them. You just leave the students protest, do whatever they want, ignore them, and then let Occupy a movement, Occupy Central go on without any incidents. And because Beijing had made up its mind that it wasn't going to change anything, and after a few days, people realized that they can't do anything. You know, they can sing, they can yell slogans, they can do whatever, make speeches. And if nothing's going to happen, people would just lose steam and go home. And also, until last Thursday, I would say that there were still a lot of Hong Kong people who were a little bit uneasy about the disruptions that would be caused by Occupy Central. And in fact, that was the reason why the Occupy Central leaders decided to choose October 1st, a public holiday, in order to minimize disruption. And now with the tear gas, and on Saturday and Sunday, actually many people really show up to the protest site only after they saw the police started to use tear gas. They couldn't believe that this would happen in Hong Kong. And they were so outraged that they wanted to actually give more support to people who were already there. And so this is basically a case of just backfiring. So the protests have become bigger and bigger, and there's a lot more sympathy for the protesters and more support for UK. If you know there are going to be disruptions, things are going to, many shops are going to be closed, trees are closed, and then buses can't really run, so be it. There's a lot more important at stake.
So are we, though, in an alternative universe here, given the press blackout on the mainland, and now the Chinese censors have really gone after the internet, particularly social media, Instagram, Weibo have shut down Twitter feeds, Baidu have shut down websites. The Chinese authorities have ordered all websites to, quote, immediately clear away information about Hong Kong students violently assaulting the government and about Occupy Central. So it does feel like in an alternative universe, what's happening in Hong Kong. And how much do you think the Chinese people are learning about what's really happening? Because you mentioned the tear gas, use of tear gas backfiring. My understanding is that by shutting down social media, perhaps the Chinese authorities have alerted the Chinese citizens to what's going on more than they would had they ignored it.
Well, so it is a different matter whether or not what is going on in Hong Kong is going to have an impact in China. Obviously, Beijing is very worried about that. But what is interesting is that this is not new. And there's another thing is that actually for a long, long time, and Hong Kong people really, Hong Kong pro-democracy forces have been very consciously trying to really avoid saying that, you know, we want to do anything beyond Hong Kong. They have actually exercised this self-restraint. We are just talking about Hong Kong. We only want to have genuine elections. We only want to have high degree of autonomy in Hong Kong. We are not even going to talk about China. So this is actually has been a very long-standing position of the pro-democracy forces in Hong Kong. Now, of course, at the same time, Beijing has been doing that. It has actually quarantined Hong Kong. So even Hong Kong's major newspapers, all the Chinese newspapers, they're blocked when you're inside China. You can't really read Hong Kong's newspapers because Hong Kong newspapers, even before this protest, they were presumed to be subversive. They would say too many things that Beijing didn't really want its own citizens to know about. So this blackout is not new at all. What is interesting is that, well, For the very determined people, they can always scale the Great Firewall. And there were also pictures of individual citizens from Shanghai and different places putting up signs and taking pictures to express their solidarity with the people in Hong Kong. But, of course, those people have to take immense risk. Now, there's another thing, is that there are also a lot of mainland students studying in Hong Kong and mainland students studying in the U.S., so all those students, then, you know, they know what is going on. And I'm not sure, you know, if China wants to participate in the globalized economy, you just can't block up everything. But at the same time, even for those people who really know what is going on, to what extent that matters, given that Hong Kong's pro-democracy forces have really been consciously trying to actually limit their own causes to within Hong Kong's boundary. There was this saying that a long time ago, Deng Xiaoping was warning Hong Kong, you know, make sure that the Well River doesn't spill over into the river, because, you know, we are the China is the river, and we are not going to spill into your well, and your well water shouldn't spill into the river. And that's been a kind of a deal that actually both sides have held on to.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, that I'm speaking with Victoria Hoy, who's a professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame. She has worked in the democracy movement in Hong Kong and now serves on the Academic Advisors Committee of the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict. So if the Chinese authorities have been successful all along in quarantining news, obviously the President Xi will not tolerate any kind of protest either in Hong Kong or on the mainland itself. And my understanding is that there's a continual kind of cat and mouse game going on the internet, on social media, that citizens in the mainland, as well as clearly in Hong Kong, keep pushing the envelope. In terms of giving us a sense of how this battle is going, Is the government winning and will it always win?
Well, as you said, because when it comes to just internet control in China, so we're talking about that rather than what is going on in Hong Kong. As you said, because it's a cat and mouse game, it is like fighting a counterinsurgency. So it looks like, you know, the government can control a lot. And in a way that, because the government actually can just insert automatic control, people who post something subversive can be blocked right at the source. You can say that in that sense, the government is winning. But then there are also many determined citizens who really know how to get around that. So, for example, in the early stage, that when words were censored, then people began to post pictures because then pictures couldn't be censored by you just automatic mechanism of checking on words. And so after that, the regime responded by just hiring more people and trying to actually then censor also pictures. So pictures is, these days are censored, but it takes, you know, actually real people to take them off, to delete them from the web. It is a cat and mouse game. In a cat and mouse game, it is really hard to know who is really winning the game. So this is one thing. But Hong Kong people, so far, what I wanted to say is that in a way that they don't really want to take the fight to mainland China. The one reason I mentioned, because essentially they were very conscious, they don't really want, they don't, because of also the legacy of Tiananmen, in 1989, people formed the alliance in support of the patriotic and democratic development in mainland China, and Hong Kong people mobilized a lot of money and resources, and people would take them to Beijing. And after that, and also at the same time, at the time, people understood that today's Tiananmen, tomorrow's Hong Kong, that was one of the more prominent slogans at the time. So Hong Kong people understand that what is going on in Beijing has important ramifications for Hong Kong's fight for democracy and autonomy. People know that, but actually since then, there was this very conscious effort to quarantine Hong Kong. But at the same time, though, these days there's a different reason. Is that the gap between Hong Kong and mainland China has actually grown wider and wider. There have been actually much stronger sentiments against mainland Chinese, also much stronger sentiments that, you know, we are Hong Kong people, we're very different. And there's even people who are saying that we're not Chinese. Now, how I'm not sure that sentiment is widely shared, that Hong Kong, you know, is so unique that we don't even care what happens in China. There's the sentiment. And when on June 4th now, there's a separate candlelight vigil because people really don't like that the alliance, which is the main organizer of the main candlelight vigil, it's Victoria Park. They feel that because in that message, there's this still the presumption that Hong Kong is a part of China. We care about what is happening in China. But now some people actually don't care. So for both reasons, for both an old reason and a new reason, that there's this quarantine. And so Hong Kong people, I don't think, really try to break the Great Firewall to get the message into China. So it is really the Chinese that's very nervous, and Beijing that's very nervous about stopping the message. It's not like, you know, Hong Kong people try to play this cat and mouse game. Hong Kong people are not.
Well, my understanding is that if you own a Chinese phone, a Chinese brand, they build in a mechanism that means that they can detect your messages in the phones themselves. And that one of the ways that the people in Hong Kong are getting around this Chinese firewall is using an app called FireChat, which is an off-the-grid messaging app that uses Bluetooth without being connected to the internet. But that apparently has been used so much in Hong Kong that the wireless system crashed.
I think what happened was, yesterday on Sunday, was that there were rumors that the chief executive was going to give an order to shut down the networks in the entire west from the Western District to through Central to Admiralty and Wan Chai, where all the protesters were gathering. Because, again, people were talking, and then this time, actually, in this particular case, social media play a very important role. People were actually watching what was being posted on Facebook, and then so that was why, after the main organizers, the Students' Federation, told people, well, let's just have a total retreat because we're worried that the police was going to use rubber bullets. So they issued an order to retreat, but people didn't retreat. And then there were people posting comments on Facebook that let's, you know, go occupy other places. So that people were spreading into Central, going to Causeway Bay and Mong Kok. And because it was actually in response to the rumor or whatever, there was actually planned, but somehow they didn't carry it out, that the government was going to shut down all the networks. So then there was this also call for everyone to download FireCheck. But it was really intended to communicate among Hong Kong protesters. It wasn't. I didn't see any message at the time that, you know, that people say, well, let's actually use FireChat in order to break the China's firewall. I think people were really trying to talk among each other. As I said, Hong Kong people care most of all about what is going on in Hong Kong rather than breaking through the China's great firewall.
Well, apparently one thing that unites the protesters in Hong Kong is their deep dislike for the Beijing-imposed leader, Luang Chun-ying. Is that true, that they're demanding his resignation, which I take it is not particularly likely?
Right. It is definitely true. And also, in a way that many people actually have pointed out that maybe to some extent Occupy Central adopted a very bad strategy, because they announced in about January last year that the Hong Kong government should actually come up with a very solid proposal with also genuine consultation. Otherwise, we're going to occupy Central. Well, the problem was that because they announced it so far ahead, then there was a lot of time for the Hong Kong government to then put together what now later, you know, in hindsight, we understand not very genuine consultation. And then Beijing issued this white paper. So what happened with the previous cases when people power in Hong Kong could actually force the government to back down? So first, in 2003, with the national security legislation, so at the time, Beijing apparently was telling at the then chief executive, Tong Qinhua, that he was supposed to introduce the national security law to Hong Kong as soon as possible. And then he tried, and then 500,000 people were on the street. And so the government backed down. And then last year, the national education arrangement, so there was this idea that there was this policy that, well, the government was going to actually make sure that Hong Kong people are not patriotic enough, and therefore we have to make sure that they understand enough about the Chinese mainland system. And then also then about 100,000 people were massing at the central government offices. And then the government also backed down when they had, you know, basically announced to Hong Kong people that we're not going to back down. We're really going to do this. But they eventually shelved. In both cases, they backed down in the sense that they didn't take the agenda off the table completely. They said that we're going to shelve it. And so in both cases, that people power worked because they managed to get the Hong Kong government to rethink before Beijing actually issued any verdict. And all along, Beijing would always be very clever. They wanted to make sure that they wouldn't be the focus of people's anger, but using everything through the Hong Kong government. This time, now, of course, then it is different. One, because Occupy Central was announced so long ago, so Beijing issued a verdict, we're not going to do anything. But at the same time, too, Hong Kong people understand that it is, to some extent, it is very strategic. Your protesters now, they yell slogans like, you know, down with the central government and all that. The risk will be a lot higher. They're hoping that by bringing down the CY government, the current chief executive, if someone else comes to power, that maybe, you know, they can reopen negotiations. So this is the hope. But you're absolutely right that people are really upset about Beijing.
So, but we know that President Xi is drawing the line. He won't tolerate any protest. And apparently his anti-corruption campaign is very popular with the Chinese people, even if it may not be quite as robust as he pretends it is in terms of going after top officials. They seem to be going after mostly local officials. So do you think that in the long run, I mean, I imagine it's out of the question that the mainland would crack down altogether and simply abolish the one country, two systems project?
Now, okay, again, there are two issues here. One is what happens in China and what happens in Hong Kong. It is true that Xi Jinping, you know, if he could choose, he wouldn't want to see any protests in Hong Kong or in mainland China. That is definitely true. The only and then it is also true that in a way that, you know, if they could abolish the one country, two system promise, that they would happily do that. And in fact, a lot of people point out or argue that the white paper issued by Beijing a few months ago is tantamount to just renouncing the whole one country, two systems model, because the one country, two systems model promises that there will be a genuine degree of high degree of autonomy, and also Hong Kong people ruling Hong Kong. And the basic law also promises that there will be actually elections of the chief executive. Now, why is the election of the chief executive so important? Because actually, Beijing has been hiding behind the chief executives we've had. As I said, you know, Beijing wanted Hong Kong to impose the national security bill. Well, go it through Hong Kong. So they looks like a Hong Kong initiative. They wanted Hong Kong to introduce national education going through the chief executive. So this time, again, they want to say that this is, you know, what Hong Kong people wanted. So when the Hong Kong government issued this consultation report, they said that Hong Kong people really welcome, you know, whatever arrangement that Beijing wanted. It sounds like this is not imposition from the top. So this is one problem. But otherwise, in a way, really, Beijing would have no hesitation in renouncing the one country, two systems model, but without saying so too explicitly, but still saying that, you know, everything is right, and keeps telling Hong Kong people that, you know, whatever arrangement they have now, that we are going to dictate the candidates, although you guys get to vote. It's very democratic, and that's what they say. Yeah. At the same time, though, Hong Kong is very different from mainland China. This is why, you know, in a way that it is very strategic for Hong Kong protesters to draw a line. Yesterday, why the police use of tear gas really backfires? Because Hong Kong people are already mobilized. Hong Kong people are so used to protesting on the street. When people are angry about something, just you easily have several hundreds of thousands of people pouring onto the street. And then at the same time, a very good case in point is that Joshua Wang, the very young student leader of scholarism of high school, a student's body of high school students, he was arrested, and then the police kept him without actually charging him for 48 hours. That was illegal. And then lawyer tried to get habeas corpus, and they won. And so the police had to release him. Hong Kong still, at the moment, we can't say, you know, what's going to happen 10 years later. Hong Kong still has an independent judiciary. This is something very different. So while Xi Jinping really would not like to have protests in Hong Kong, he still really can't control the judiciary. And of course, this is one of those things that they really would like to, you know, basically put a stop to. But so far, they haven't been able to do that. And then in China, they don't like to have protests. So because a lot of protests are about corruption, and so the anti-corruption campaign is partly popular. But then it is also not popular in the sense that people are also very cynical. Yeah, you're catching tigers as well as flies, but the big tigers, you know, who are those big tigers that you have actually been trying to catch? Your own political rivals. Will really believe it when you actually also, you know, put your own family members to trial. So ultimately, to what extent that, you know, this intolerance for protests is going to be successful, we still have to wait and see.
Well, Victoria Hoi, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Victoria Hoi, who's a professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame, where her research examines the dynamics of international politics and state-society relations in historical China and historical Europe. She's the author of War and State Formation in Ancient China and Early Modern Europe, and has worked in the democracy movement in Hong Kong, and now serves on the Academic Advisors Committee of the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about how the shadow of Tiananmen Square hangs over the Chinese leadership. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Perry Link, who holds a Chancellorial Chair for Innovative Teaching Across Disciplines and is also a Professor of Comparative Literature and Foreign Languages at the University of California, Riverside. He's one of the world's foremost experts on China's language, culture, and people, and has translated many Chinese stories, writings, and poems into English. And in the 1990s, he edited the Tiananmen Papers, a collection of documents leaked by a high-level Chinese official that helped chronicle the events that led up to and followed the pro-reform student protest in June of 1989. He was blacklisted by the Chinese government in 1996. Welcome to Background Briefing, Perry Link.
My pleasure to be here.
And what do you make of the so-called umbrella revolution going on now in Hong Kong? Because you get the feeling that particularly with the Chinese leader Xi, that he and his colleagues are haunted somewhat by the memories of Tiananmen, and the idea that this is a student protest defying the orders of the government.
Yes, the shadow of Tiananmen certainly hovers over what's going on in Hong Kong. The Chinese government has to be afraid of retreading their reputation before the world from what happened 25 years ago when that spectacular massacre really cost them a lot of credibility. I think the students themselves have that shadow hanging over them, too. They're not as naive as the students in Beijing were 25 years ago. I was in Beijing 25 years ago and saw the students, and they assumed that the government wouldn't bring out tanks and shoot them. But now the students in Hong Kong know that that has happened, and they are aware that if push comes to shove, they can be outshoved. And they're also much more sophisticated about what democracy means. They are, after all, their main protest now is about how nominees to universal suffrage will be done. The question of universal suffrage isn't under discussion. Beijing has said, yes, you can have universal suffrage for the CEO of Hong Kong starting in 2017. But Beijing, playing its normal language games, says that we will have to vet all of the candidates and this way assure that only pro-Beijing people can run. And that's the issue that the students are focused on. They say, no, we have to have genuinely popularly nominated candidates as well.
So in terms of the Hong Kong police, and they aren't the mainland police, they're the Hong Kong police that are cracking down on the students, their use of tear gas seemed to have backfired. The demonstrations have got larger. They haven't dwindled. And more regular citizens are joining in the demonstrations. So what do you think is going on in Beijing with the Chinese leadership as they watch this and obviously want to keep a firewall to stop this contagion spreading to the mainland?
Well, I like your word firewall, because I think the main worry among the leaders in Beijing is that if democracy does take hold in Hong Kong, it will not be just Hong Kong. It will be a demonstration example to cities all across China that Chinese culture and democracy work well together. And they don't want that precedent to be there. That's really their worry. I have trouble sympathizing with the men in Beijing, but I must say I sort of do here. They have a really tough decision, because they will not retreat on the question of keeping democracy at their pace at most and as far away as they can. That's their bottom line, as it were. But how then to handle these growing protests must be a real headache, because, as you just pointed out, they ordered the use of tear gas. Now, tear gas is mild compared to what was used in Beijing, but still, in Hong Kong, it came as a shock. It's the first time there'd been tear gas in Hong Kong, I think, since the Cultural Revolution era in 1967. There were similar riots, and the British government at the time used some tear gas. But it shocked people, and as you point out, backfired from the point of view of tamping down the demonstrations. More people came out on Monday because of what they saw as the heavy-handed treatment by police. Before we leave the police, I'd like to make one point. The police in Hong Kong are in quite a different situation from the soldiers in Beijing 25 years ago. The soldiers in Beijing were brought in from the countryside, told a story about rioters in the heart of the city. They didn't know anything except that they were supposed to go and wipe them out. The police in Beijing are homegrown Hong Kong guys who couldn't get into university, and here these university students who have won out against them in that competition are protesting. I feel sorry for those police in a sense. They're taking orders. To use tear gas or not is not their decision. It's not even a local Hong Kong decision. I'm quite sure exactly what to use and how to use it is dictated from Beijing. And so the police are a different case from what they were in China 25 years ago as well.
So could this lead to a standoff like Tiananmen that could end in a bloody crackdown? I mean, how much do you think? Couldn't they abandon, for example, the one country, two systems? They could just suddenly decide, well, it's not working. Let's have one country, one system.
Well, if one country, one system means that, yes, the People's Liberation Army takes over the streets of Kowloon and Hong Kong, they could do that. That would be quite shocking to the people in Hong Kong and to the rest of the world that's watching. I think that if they really feel, by they I mean the leaders in Beijing, really feel there's no alternative but to do that, they will. But they will be very reluctant about going that far because of the experience in Beijing 25 years ago. They don't want that terrible reputation that's haunted them all through these 25 years. I mean, they have a public campaign to forget the memory, and it's abolished, it's banned from the media and the school curricula and so on, but it haunts them, and they remember, and every time the sensitive period of the 25th, 26th anniversary comes along, they block off Tiananmen Square. They're very worried, and they don't want the replay of that. So it really is, in my mind, quite dramatic what will happen if the protests continue, because it's a tough choice in Beijing between cracking down and risking that reputation or not, which means that what if the democracy does take root in Hong Kong? Then they have to worry about the demonstration effect all across China that they certainly don't want. It's a tough call.
Again, I'm speaking with Perry Link, who is one of the world's foremost experts on China's language, culture, and people, and has translated many Chinese stories, writings, and poems into English. In the 1990s, he edited the Tiananmen Papers, a collection of documents leaked by a high-level Chinese official that helped chronicle the events that led up to and followed the pro-reform student protests in June of 1989, and he was blacklisted by the Chinese government in 1996. And Perry Link, you mentioned how the Chinese have rewritten history and sanitized all references to Tiananmen. And what they did essentially was they promised, they stoked the fires of nationalism and promised materialism, which they've delivered on. And that seems right. to have satisfied the students' democracy. And you mentioned earlier that Chinese culture and democracy are compatible. And I guess that's an experiment that's been postponed indefinitely. What's going on, though, with social media? There's cracking down on that. My understanding is that that gets the attention of the young Chinese more than anything. That maybe they've given up on democracy and they're happy with materialism and nationalism, but they don't like their information being screwed with by the government, my understanding is.
Well, of course not, yes. And that's even more important in mainland China than it is in Hong Kong. In mainland China, where the state-sponsored media, of course, is well-watched and censored, the social media has taken on a tremendous importance in spreading news and has had actually a salutary effect on the state-run media, because when people have their cell phones and can take pictures of actions in action and put them on the internet, it puts a pressure on the state media to do as well. Otherwise, no one will pay any attention to them. They'll just look at their cell phones. And in Hong Kong, the same effect is there. Of course, this is worldwide. The importance of the state, of the social media, was very important in the Arab Spring, and it's been important everywhere. But in Hong Kong, when these kinds of protests come along, the social media, just as I understand from my friends there, buzzes off the hook. They're just very, very active. And to repress that, of course, seems like a real slap in the face. This is just another example of the dilemma that the rulers in Beijing face. Do you allow social media just to do whatever they want to do or not? And if you do, they spread all of these things you don't want spread. If you don't, you get a very bad reputation for being repressive. It's another dilemma.
Well, I get the impression, though, that what really at the bottom line for these leaders is, and they've got this kind of phony corruption campaign going, which is quite popular, where our previous guest said they go after the tigers and the flies, but they most spend most of their time going after the flies and not the tigers. And my understanding is that the only top officials that have been caught up in the anti-corruption net are retired officials. They're certainly not going after the families of any of the incumbents. So is that their bottom line, is that they simply do not want any challenge to the Communist Party itself into the indefinite future?
All of your summary there I agree with the additional point that some of the big tigers do get attacked, but they are invariably the political opponents of the attackers. The most recent example of this is Zhou Yongkang, whom for political reasons Xi Jinping wanted to take down. And it's not the first time this has happened. 10 years ago, 20 years ago, there were clear examples of using corruption charges in order to attack your political enemies. But other than that, everything you said is right. Yes, it's the little flies that are caught more. The pervasive anti-corruption campaign around the country has put limits on what local officials can do in terms, for example, of having banquets. You know, you're not allowed to have wine, and you're only allowed to have 3 dishes and 1 soup and so on. And this has led, really, I don't have at my fingertips the latest statistics, but to a wave of suicides across the country among local officials who are caught in this. But the purpose of it is to consolidate the power of the party at the center, yes. Xi Jinping comes from a family. His father was a colleague of Mao Zedong, and his father was an idealistic communist in the 40s and 50s and has this sort of rosy idea that communism can work. Xi Jinping, in my interpretation, is a princeling. He inherits that family tradition, but then he's put into this top position of power. My impression of him is that he doesn't have much of an intellect, not much of an imagination. He knows that there's a crisis in the country. He has to do something. And so he reaches back to these ideals of his father's generation and pulls them out and said, let's try this, anti-corruption. And let's try this, pulling more power into the center. And he's done that right through the central government. He's put himself on the key committees and centralized power. But this assumes that he has the charisma and the intellect of a person like Mao Zedong or Mao's immediate successor, Deng Xiaoping, and I just don't think he does. And I think that the roving tigers among his rivals, if we can put it that way, are too strong, and he can't just pull them into line. And if he pushes his anti-corruption campaign to where they're oxes are gored. I'm mixing metaphors here, I know. But he's going to get into trouble. So for all of these reasons, I think that the situation in mainland China is much more tentative than it appears from the outside. We see a rising China, stronger, more militaristic, more diplomatically influential. But internally, there's a lot of fragility and nervousness.
Well, Perry Link, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Perry Link, who is one of the world's foremost experts on China's language, culture, and people, and has translated many Chinese stories, writings, and poems into English. In the 1990s, he edited the Tiananmen Papers, a collection of documents leaked by a high-level Chinese official that helped chronicle the events that led up to and followed the pro-reform student protests in June of 1989. He was blacklisted by the Chinese government in 1996. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the latest latest killings of Ukrainian soldiers in the continuing destabilization of Ukraine. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Anders Aslan, who's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and co-chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Kiev School of Economics. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine. And he's the author of How Ukraine Became a Market Economy and a Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anders Aslan.
Thank you very much.
And apparently 9 Ukrainian soldiers died in the deadliest post-truce attack. I think their armored personnel carrier was hit by pro-Russian rebel artillery near the Donetsk airport. And I'm wondering whether there's this – what kind of theater is going on there? There's supposed to be a truce, but there's not really a truce. Is Putin going to continually destabilize this place, or – is there any meaning to the agreement? Because every day you get whipsawed. One day you find out Ukrainians are now getting Russian gas. The next day, a bunch of Ukrainian soldiers get killed by pro-Russian separatists.
Well, I think that there is a sort of a modus vivendi now that for a bit more than a week, there has, or 2 weeks, there has not been much fighting in the sense that the front moves, both sides are resting, moving soldiers back and forth, but you see every day that a couple of soldiers are being killed. This was more 9 soldiers in one day, but they are shooting every day. So it's unclear whether this is the beginning of a steady front, or if it's a preparation for a new attack from the Russian side. The Ukrainians are certainly not in any shape to attack now. My suspicion is that it's a new modus vivendi, because I think that Vladimir Putin's objective is, first of all, to destabilize Ukraine, and the Ukrainian economy is now in a terrible state. Industrial production fell by 21% in August. Coal production was down by 50%, steel production by 30%, because so much of the old Ukrainian heavy industry is in the small part of eastern Ukraine that is occupied by Russian irregulars and rebels.
So conversely, how much is Russia's economy being hurt by the sanctions? Because I've always wondered in this game that's going on here, if that's not too cynical a way to describe it, what is the end game in terms of who ends up paying for Ukraine? I mean, on the one hand, it seems like Putin is happy to destabilize the place and make it dysfunctional, but who's going to pick up the pieces here? Or is the pain that he's feeling from international sanctions in any way changing his mind?
Well, I think that the big pain is being borne by the Ukrainian people, but also some of the Russian people. If you look up on the forecast for Russian economic growth at the beginning of the year, they were 2.5% to 3% growth this year. And now it's 0% to 0.5%, which means that the growth, expected growth, has fallen by 2.5%. In the Russian economy, it's a 2 trillion economy, which is a direct cost in 1 year of $50 billion. I wouldn't say that this is because of the sanctions per se, but rather because of the uncertainty that they have caused. So since July, there has hardly been any international financing for any Russian enterprises or government, although much of that financing has been allowed. But international banks do not want to be involved with Russia now because they suspect that the sanctions will get worse or that they will get into some legal trouble. And on the Ukrainian side, it's a 10% decline in the GDP, and that's on the GDP that was $180 billion last year. So this is a heavy loss for the Ukrainian people.
Again, I'm speaking with Anders Aslan, who's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and co-chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Kiev School of Economics. He's worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and serves as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine. And he's the author of How Ukraine Became a Market Economy and Democracy. So, Anders Aslan, President Obama was on 60 Minutes on Sunday, and he was asked about the deterioration of U.S.-Russian relations. And by the way, the Russian foreign minister just a couple of days ago called for another reset and called for an improvement in these relations. But Obama said that he has a good working relationship with Putin, even though he said it's very blunt and to the point in terms of their conversations. But what I took away from what he said was that basically, Putin has put himself in a box. He's put himself in a trap by taking Crimea and destabilizing Ukraine, and that he has whipped up Russian sentiment through the enormous propaganda power that he has. He wields over the press in Russia since he completely controls just about all information, and he's even trying to control what's left of the internet now. And that Obama more or less suggested that, you know, it's up to Putin to come to his senses and back out of this mess because he's the one that's going to be hurt and the Russian economy is already being hurt. So I'm not sure. Do you think that Obama's understanding exactly what's going on, right, if I understand Obama correctly?
Well, I think that we can draw a certain parallel here with President Slobodan Milosevic of Serbia. He started his war activities in 1990, and he was only ousted in 2000. The Serbian economy was a complete mess. Serbia was completely isolated, and the country suffered a heavy NATO bombing in 1999. Even so, President Milosevic survived for more than a decade. If you draw the comparison with President Putin, he could sit for a long time. Eventually, I agree with President Obama that he's likely to fall because of problems he's now causing. But if that would take more than a decade, then the world will suffer a great deal.
So in terms of the foreign minister's call for resetting the relationships and putting them back on the tracks, is there any possibility? I noticed that Russia attended the Paris talks on forming an anti-Islamic state coalition. Obviously, they got great concerns in the Caucasus about these returning jihadists, assuming that they do return. Is there anything to work with there? Is there any reason to believe that things could be put back on the track?
Well, of course, this would be in the Russian interest that Moscow is getting away with the annexation of Crimea and then gets a new reset. This is just to ask for a massive favor from the United States without giving anything in return.
So you think that's really what Lavrov's asking?
Yeah. It is the West that has imposed sanctions now on Russia. And, of course, then one wants a reset. If one sits in Moscow, you can compare the situation with 2008. In August 2008, Russia attacked Georgia and took 20% of its territory. And then reset came at the beginning of 2009. And now Russia asks for the same favor once again. So the United States would make a serious mistake if it accepted another reset, because that would simply mean that the United States recognizes the right of Russia to attack and occupy territories of neighboring states. That must not be done.
But in terms of what the U.S. could do, short of that kind of a reset, what about giving some kind of guarantees or pledge about eastward expansion of NATO? Because after all, the 2008 war in Georgia should have basically told the West that this is Putin's red line and we shouldn't push for more eastward movement of NATO. And I'm not sure what the benefit is of an eastward move of NATO if you have to pay this kind of cost where you have, you know, a potential return to a kind of new Cold War.
Well, why should the West give Russia anything because it has pursued aggression? NATO expansion has not been on the table since the NATO summit in Bucharest in April 2008, which effectively stopped that process. So this is not an issue that is on the table. And I don't think that this is the reason why President Putin has attacked Ukraine. I think it's much more because Ukraine experienced a democratic breakthrough. And President Putin saw that this is a danger for himself domestically. Because if one Slavic country can succeed as a democracy, why not another one? That is Russia. So therefore, I think that this was a preemptive strike. But these are two different views. If Putin attacked because of the democratic breakthrough or because he's afraid of a Western alliance expansion.
So assuming that the latter is the real motive, and that obviously then this war has been very, very helpful for him because it's removed what any vestiges of any opposition. There was, however, a demonstration in the streets the other day in Moscow. I think about 10 to 20,000 people showed up, not the same scale as when he Putin announced his third term. So what are we therefore to expect then if this is all about one man's political ambition to maintain power and control? How do you see things? You said earlier that you think it'll take about 10 years or so before things will just... So is that what we're going to be looking forward to? A Russia that's become more and more totalitarian and more impoverished and a kind of standoff on the global stage with no sort of diplomatic cooperation?
I'm not saying that it would take 10 years, but it did take 10 years in the case of Milosevic in Serbia. And therefore, we should not necessarily expect that it will pass very fast. We can't know how fast it can pass. You have two alternative views out here. One is that we should reach an agreement with Russia. The other is containment. I'm firmly on the containment and sanction side. Because Russia has got all kinds of agreements. And by annexing Crimea, Russia has violated half a dozen major international treaties. If it treats major international agreements like that, why conclude another one? Then one simply goes back to the old technique of the Cold War deterrence, that is, a sufficient military incredible force so that Russia does not dare to attack another country or go further.
So just then in closing, Anders Aslan, what is the fate of the Russian people, particularly those, there was a brief democracy there and arguably we had spent, trillions winning the Cold War, but we certainly did not pony up very much in terms of securing the victory. And now that Putin has successfully turned back the clock and sort of become the new czar, what do you think is the fate of the Russian people in terms of particularly the intelligentsia and those on the pro-Western side? Are they simply going to be in the deep freeze, or do you think that there's any way that they can fight back?
The conventional wisdom now is that one-tenth of the population, the liberal intelligentsia, is really in the deep freeze, and that their views are not shared by the rest of the population. And I share this conventional wisdom that this is unfortunately where we are now. When hardcore nationalism has been preached by the national media for a considerable time, then normally it sticks and it's very hard to outroach. I was in Belgrade early this year, and now Serbia seems to have woken up, but it's really a country that is in a big, heavy hangover after Milosevic. And this is 14 years after he was ousted. So I think that this is a big blow to Russia for a long time, and that we in the West and also in the neighboring countries really have to firm up defenses. Unfortunately, I don't see any softer solution.
But in terms of Serbia and Russia, there seems to be something here in common, and that is that they both drank the Kool-Aid of nationalism ladled out by corrupt dictators who were in fact kleptocrats. I mean, Milosevic stole the treasury of Belgrade and parked it in banks in Cyprus, and then it brought about nothing but ruin. When you say people have a hangover in Belgrade, is the hangover because of failed nationalism, or is the hangover because they've woken up to the fact that they were taken in by a kleptocrat who stole them blind? Because that's pretty much what Putin is doing with his cronies, the Siloviki. They're stealing the country blind and using nationalism as bread and circuses.
I totally agree with your parallel here. Probably President Putin is the biggest kleptocrat in the world. A book, Putin's Kleptocracy, by Professor Karen Davisha, is just out arguing on these lines. But turning to the people of Serbia, they just don't understand why they were so badly treated. And I think this is what we eventually will see in Russia also. And you can say that this is also what the Germans felt after the Second World War. They, if you go on one of these nationalist binges, you don't feel guilty afterwards. You rather feel like a victim.
Well, Anders Hassel, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Always good to talk to you.
Again, I've been speaking with Anders Hassel, who's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and co-chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Kiev School of Economics. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine. And he is the author of How Ukraine Became a Market Economy and Democracy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcast at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.